It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
And welcome to the Dearly Departed Podcast. It's our 30th episode. Can you believe it, Scott?
Yeah, what's the 30th anniversary? There's 25.
What do you get for that?
Yeah, let's see. Let's see what that is. But yeah, thanks for bearing with us. I know it's been a while, and appreciate it.
Yeah, and while Scott looks that up, I'm Mike Dorsey.
And I'm Scott Michaels.
And this is Dearly Departed Podcast. And what do you get for 30?
Pearl. You get a pearl necklace, Mike.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. There's no double entendre with that at all.
I don't know what you mean. All right.
So I was going to ask you, since it was just Halloween, and we were going to try and do this for Halloween, because newsflash, we're going to talk about the universal monsters of the 1930s on this episode. It was a good follow-up to Freaks, Todd Browning's Freaks, which was our last episode, so it's a nice little companion piece with that. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking about, since it was just Halloween, did you ever have any Halloween traditions growing up, Scott?
We did the trick-or-treating thing. I was just talking to somebody the other day. I think I could never post pictures of like 75% of the costumes I watched for Halloween because I'd be destroyed. Everything has changed and shifted so drastically that you can't. So all of it was
for next Halloween, you'd have to go with someone who was canceled.
yes. What would you do? Just put one of those. Yeah, I did go one time as a clown police. And this is back in the 80s. This is before there was an internet. But I did go. We had my friend Bohannon and I. We wore berets. We had we put little clown bozo symbols with slashes through them, and I had a bozo lunchbox, and in it I had clown makeup remover and pins for animals, for balloon animals, and we're just like military with like mag lights and stuff, but it was the anti-clown police. So that was one of the good ones that I can talk about. I was an army kid, but yeah, just a regular trick-or-treating business. We did the Devil's Night thing too, which was I think that was an exclusive to Detroit thing.
That is a Detroit thing. Yeah.
So it was the night before Halloween. We called it Devil's Night, and we would go out. It was prank fun. It wasn't nice. It was mean, but it was kids like writing things on windows with soap. You know, it wasn't permanent damage, but it was vandalism. And in the 60s and 70s, it was, you know, it was a little bit more of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of a thing. Now, you know, anyone walking around the night before Halloween is you couldn't do it anymore. But it was just a different time, and I'm not proud of it, but it was just one of those things. And then it became a whole different thing in Detroit where, you know, became famous for, you know, people lighting cars on fire and stuff like that. That was after I left Detroit. It became a whole different thing. And so then they decided to rename it Angel Night instead. But the fire department were always, but back when we were kids, it was like throwing eggs and ringing doorbells and running. Sure. And that's all So it was more innocent. I'm not saying it was innocent, but anyway, right. Detroit, man, we were hardcore.
Devil's Night. I mean, when I was a little kid, I liked the Disney Channel Halloween stuff on Halloween night. It was always fun to watch because you always go trick-or-treating and then you'd come home and put on, you know, Halloween programming. And, you know, that's not exactly, you know, no Devil's Night for me, I guess. One time in college, one of my more tasteless costumes was I went as Buddy Holly after the plane crash.
Oh.
And my girlfriend at the time went as the president of the Buddy Holly fan club. And she was my
Did they weep? Stand next to you and just cry?
And, it was pretty dark. I'll just say that. It was pretty dark. But her outfit was basically just like a 50s dress, you know, and I had like a cardigan, and I had a guitar at the time, an electric guitar. So I walked around with a Fender, but I put like branches in the Fender. It was It's one of those things that seems okay at the time, but when you get older, you're like,
screw it. It's funny.
It's Halloween.
It's like, you know, Princess Diana with a steering wheel around her neck. That's funny. I'm sorry. You know, yeah, cancel me. I, you know, the whole thing is that we're inappropriate. It's a laugh. Right. We're not going, hooray, Diana's dead. We're not going, hooray, right. Buddy Holly's dead. But, you know, right. for God's sake, just lighten up. I mean, it's in bad taste. That's the whole point. But
exactly, it's not serious.
But I would never tell you what I dressed up as.
News of the week.
Another thing I wanted to talk about, and I know you wanted to talk about this too. Big news. Whenever you think you're having like a bad week or a bad month, Robert Durst was convicted for killing Susan Berman. He got COVID and was also now been charged with his former wife's murder from 1982, all in the span of like a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So your life could always go worse.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, Durst was, he was the subject of the show, the famous documentary.
The Jinx.
The Jinx. And very famously basically confessed while on camera. And they could use that, couldn't they? They could use that. He was at a urinal and just talking to himself.
Yeah.
But he was still mic'd. Yeah. And he gave permission to be recorded. So it was fair game, wasn't it? For them to use that.
Yeah. And the filmmakers always, was it Jarecki, I think is the filmmaker's name. I think they've claimed that they didn't find that footage until much, much later into the editing process. I don't know if I totally believe that, but whatever. I'll take their word for it.
It makes sense. I mean, because it is a throwaway. If you're going to go, you know, you're going to the bathroom, you would just throw that away.
It's very unusual when you cut camera, though, for sound to keep rolling.
Mm.
And they did show them planning that interview out in detail. They made it part of the film, like they're planning, because it was the second time they were interviewing him. So they were trying to figure out, you know, what questions to ask and whatever. I don't know. I always wonder, I have no inside information on this, but I always wonder if it was completely.
You think it was contrived? It's possible it could be contrived that they
did it for ratings. They knew he had been caught mumbling on a hot mic in the first interview, and I think his lawyer or somebody, a rep or somebody, was there with him and went over and had to tell him to shut up, because they're like, you know, they were between. They kind of were taking a break, but he was still sitting in his chair. And this was the first interview where he didn't confess, but he was kind of mumbling things. And a woman went over and warned him, hey, they can hear what you're saying. You need to be careful what you're saying. So as a filmmaker, I mean, just as hypothetical as a filmmaker, I would be thinking, okay, we already caught him on a hot mic once. We know he tends to do that. So I will tell my sound guy, hey, when we cut, you keep rolling until I come to you and specifically tell you to cut, because he might say some stuff. So let's get it. And then they got it. But then I guess there's somebody I know that knows the filmmakers, and they are adamant that it was a total accident. And that I guess originally they were going to end the series with the letter with Beverly Hills misspelled. That was going to be their big reveal moment at the end. And then somewhere toward the end of the editing, they caught that extra audio, found it and realized they had like something even better than the envelope. Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah, Durst, I mean, Durst, well, he's been convicted, so you could say he murdered Susan Berman, who was basically a mob daughter, and lived in Benedict Canyon, on Benedict Canyon Boulevard, and was shot in the back of the head, and Durst was convicted, found guilty of her murder. But there was
like 2000 that happened, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. And then there was an anonymous letter sent to the Beverly Hills Police Department. And, you know, the word Beverly Hills, Beverly, I think, was misspelled. And he had
done that.
It
was spelled EY.
It was totally traced back to him. So, yeah, he was found guilty. And then that whole, what a bizarre story.
It was a letter where he wrote to let them know that there was, he used the word cadaver. So they called it a cadaver letter. But it was to let them know that there was a dead body in Susan Berman's house. So I guess he was her friend, you know, and he murdered her. So maybe he felt somewhat bad about it and wanted to make sure that they found her body, I guess.
Yeah.
So he sent that.
I mean, that would be pretty ugly. Well, you know, it's like four doors down from where George Reeves died of a gunshot wound to the head. You know, it's like
crazy.
That whole crazy neighborhood. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we talked about that before, but
the Benedict Canyon curse.
There has to be a Manson connection, doesn't there? We always have one.
Always. Always. Durst is it's wild. I was surprised that they are now charging him officially with the murder or I think they've charged or considering charging. I think they did charge him with the murder of his first wife that has never been found. They've always assumed that she was murdered. She disappeared under mysterious circumstances, which was, you know, also covered in the Jinx. It would be nice if he would at least, you know, assuming that he was responsible, it would be nice if he would at least tell them where he put her.
But mm-hmm.
I don't know if they'll ever, I don't know if her family ever get that closure, you know?
Yeah, right. It's, what a mess. And he's just this crumpled little old man now. And he's going to die in prison. It's, you know, it's sad. It's just people are demented. Anyway.
What else, man?
Well, there was we should touch on the Alec Baldwin thing. That was crazy. It's so sad and so bad that that there was a live weapon on the set of that movie Alec Baldwin, you know, really just killed the guy. I mean, it's just the fact that he killed the woman. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's such a, to have that on your conscience and just, you know, to have that, is this gun okay? Yes, it's okay. Okay, here you are, you know?
And yeah, I mean, here's an actor who's handled tons of firearms throughout his career and has had, you know, all you trust the people that handed the armor on set and the assistant director have checked it. And for whatever reason, the gun hadn't been checked. And the craziest thing is they're saying it was a real live bullet. Because sometimes when they say live round, that can also mean a blank. But I guess they've since specified, no, it was an actual bullet that came out of the gun. And what in the world a live bullet was doing on a movie set is, you know, it's questions on top of questions with this one. And it makes me really upset to even think about it. But,
you know, there's one other thing, too, that's something that is... And it's a terrible situation, and this is not in any way being accusatory of anything, but anyone that's handled or learned to handle a firearm, you never pointed at anybody. I know that that's part of the movie. So that's what you're supposed to do. But yeah, it just seems like I would be very uncomfortable, you know, doing that. But it doesn't even matter what I just said, because the whole point was he's supposed to shoot somebody with it.
And he's supposed to aim the gun at the camera, so there's going to be a person standing there. So he thinks he's holding an empty gun, and he's showing, this is what I'm going
to
do.
Oh, and man, it goes to have off. That on your conscience. It's so sad. Yeah. You would think, you know, that's happened before with John Eric Hexum and Brandon Lee. And, you know, granted, you know, Hexum was a stupid mistake on his part. But yeah. They're just, you know, they're making this big deal about there should never be a live ammunition on a movie set. Well, there just shouldn't, you know,
right.
They're just done.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
There should not. And I don't see why they don't make fake guns, or why they put real firearms on the set. You know, fake guns are pretty convincing, and that's what prop people do. So,
I mean, I had a gun on the set of my, the recreations I shot for Murder Rap. We used an airsoft gun. So it's a gun that does not even cannot shoot real bullets to begin with. It's just gas powered. It's made to shoot plastic pellets. So even if it was loaded, which are made to be shot at people, I mean, it can't hurt you kind of thing.
It just needs to demonstrate some kind of kickback, I guess.
But it shows but the gas power makes the slide pop back on a semi-automatic. So it looks realistic when you're pulling the trigger and you get a little recoil off of that. I don't understand why. I don't understand why they don't have why they don't have guns that go through all the mechanics of shooting a gun, but don't have a barrel and a hammer that actually ignites a round and can fire something down a barrel. I don't understand why you need that part of it. You can have a slide that kicks back when you pull the trigger and something come out the barrel, you know, the end of the gun, just like pop, like a, you know, a cap or whatever come out. There's no reason to have a working chamber barrel hammer. I don't understand why you need all that. So Hutchins was the cinematographer's name who passed away, so rest in peace to her.
And God bless her family, man. Alec Baldwin's family, that's just awful. Anyway,
everybody was there that day is going to be traumatized from it. So
mm-hmm.
Well, moving on, do you have any other news, or do you want to move on to hate mail?
let's move on to hate mail.
Hate mail.
All right. You said you had some good ones.
It's mostly trolling for trolls. I get feedback on my YouTube videos, and I save the comments. Troy's been saving them, and I ask him not to tell me what they say, and just to send them to me for this, because what you'll do is you'll hear these coming out for the first time. These comments have been sent to me. Troy have saved them, and I'm going to read them to you. And
for the first time, you have not seen these yet.
Yeah.
This okay. Well,
maybe there's not as many as I hoped. So somebody, I did a true crime artifact. I was showing some of the things in my collection, and somebody wrote, Alex C wrote, "Why do you collect such shit? Why not collect an entire painting that the subject actually looked at and appreciated the same way you can today, or a car that he or she drove? What the is this broken handles and pieces of pottery? Sorry, but collecting a scrap of a building material is just sad." It's like, okay, well, that's not that good.
Go find your own hobby, Alex.
Yeah. The David White, I did a David White video about him and his son being in the Pan Am Lockerbie bombing. David White played Larry Tate. Somebody called Crazy Train, who has a Manson icon, with the swastika on his forehead, and said, "Dearly Departed Tours is an old dinosaur. It's kind of like watching a 1.5-year-old toddler squeal with excitement because they picked up a piece of garbage off the street and think it is a treasure. Boring and redundant." I don't think it's redundant at all. Maybe boring, but I don't think it's redundant.
I think we need to, I think they need to pick a metaphor and stick with it. You're both a dinosaur and a toddler. How is that possible?
That's actually, yeah, a very good point.
Come on. I'm just saying for the next comment that guy makes, you know, just a little writing tip, you know, don't mix your metaphors up.
Well, Troy will, you know, he's kind about it, because sometimes they're upsetting because they really, upsetting is not the right word for it, but they're annoying because they go after, they're not even being creative, you know, they're just saying you're big and ugly and stupid. It's like, oh, you know, ha ha ha, very funny. And so, you know, that gets exhausting because, you know, no one has to tell me what I look like, but anyway, so let's see what this one, Jackson, keep, okay. I don't even know what this means, and I don't even remember what video it's from. Jackson. Oh, Michael Jackson. This is Michael Jackson. Okay. I did a thing. I knew where he's buried. Jackson, keep her jeans, Jesus, if she needs a meter. Jesus did not Jewish, have had, he has held, ID, is just jealous, I different January, I'd keep is.
Sounds like somebody had their voice to text on and didn't know it.
Let's see if I can find another one. I plan on preserving the toilet the museum owners will overdose on and sending pictures of it to their families, you know, for history. It's funny.
Haven't you commented on that in the past, though? Like, you want to be on a death tour or something like that someday, or you wouldn't mind it or something like that?
Have I?
I replied
to them.
No. I'm just, haven't you ever talked about that before? Because people have criticized you. Said, I hope somebody drives, you know, by your house after you die or something like that.
Oh,
does a
yeah.
tour of your house or
yeah.
whatever, right?
Yeah. I mean, that goes back to that thing that, you know, the people dying two times. The first time you die is when you physically die and draw your last breath. And the second time is when someone says your name for the last time out loud.
Right.
So it's like, well, shit, drive by my house. At least you'll be saying my name, you know?
Right.
Exactly. I'm fine with that. I don't want to be forgotten.
And you're not around to be offended by it anymore anyways. So who cares?
That's true. Okay. So that was that one. Somebody was angry about the Cabazon dinosaurs. That doesn't really matter. Let's see.
Wait, somebody was mad about the dinosaurs?
Yeah, the Cabazon dinosaurs. That I posted a video because they painted them to look like the Flintstones.
Yeah.
And so Dino is purple, the dinosaur is purple, and the T-Rex is looking like Fred. And I said, isn't that kind of cool? And they said, I don't think it's cool at all. Just like I don't think it's cool what they did to Hadley's or that other casino is there. Fast food chains have littered the area. What was once an oasis of uniqueness is now just another monument to greed. You can have it. And it's like, or...
I have to agree with them, though. I do hate what they did with Hadley's. out there.
I don't even know what Hadley's is, Mike. Nothing to me. I don't. What does that mean?
Yeah, so Hadley's for decades and decades was famous for their date shakes. And it was this cool-looking, almost like roadhouse-looking freestanding restaurant building that they were in. And now Hadley's is in, like, a strip mall and is all, like, clean and modern. And it's still good. I mean, you still get the date I still recommend Hadley's date shakes, but it's not like the charm of it is all gone.
I see.
What they used to have. Yeah, Hadley's. That was big with our family. We used to stop in at Hadley's a lot.
I mean, the dinosaurs are still cool. I mean, that's just like Americana, you know, that's just something silly on the side of the road and whatever. I mean, they were all faded out and falling apart a couple of years ago. So now they embrace it and they're kitschy and they're fun. Anyway,
they keep generating new interest in them so they don't get kind of, well, you know. So they don't turn into dinosaurs.
And they've got new, they have new things in their gift shop. So it's like a cooler vibe to it than it used to be. They embrace the kitsch. And I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see. This one is, I did a thing about Princess Grace's hearse. And I went to the National Museum of Funeral History in Houston. And I opened up the hearse and I sat in it. You know, the hearse that carried Princess Grace's body. So I was rude. It was rude and indignant. In letter N, disgusting of you to open up the hearse in sitting in it, disrespectful to Princess Grace. I was liking the video up to that point. I will not subscribe. Sad face. So yeah, I wrote my comment was, oh no, please don't go, please, I beg you.
By the way, speaking of Princess Grace, I a few months ago, I found like a little short documentary that was shot back at the time when she got married. It was all about the wedding preparations and the wedding day, you know, all the stuff in Monaco. It was interesting. It was very, you know, positive, rah-rah kind of a documentary about the day. But it was really entertaining and informative. And it was cool to see all the footage, all the old, like, 16-millimeter footage, it looked like, that they shot of all that stuff.
It's interesting because you know who was an integral part of doing that? I think we may have talked about that, but the documentary, The Royal Family, that Prince Philip Queen Elizabeth, they featured in The Crown quite heavily, but he was, you know, spearheaded this drive to sort of open the doors on the royal family and show them as normal people or humans, not normal because they'll never
humanize
be normal.
Them, yeah.
But yeah, and it is very interesting. So they're kind of just going on to that that sort of theme is showing them as humans. And plus, she was a princess, she was a movie star, and you know, fascinating, interesting story and tragic death.
And I mean, Rear Window is my favorite movie, and she was just like iconic level gorgeous in that film.
So I did this other video really recently. The last one I did was this lady who has a wax museum in her house. Mm-hmm. She has literally the Movie Land Wax Museum. She has like the entire Wizard of Oz in her bed, in her living room, like with the Yellow Brick Road and the trees. She has the Phantom of the Opera with the organ, like a real organ. This is in her living room. She has a W.C. Fields. She has there's the Shaggy D.A. and the absent-minded professor, Fred McMurray, in a car that flew. She has the car hanging in her living room. I mean, it's a life-size car with Fred McMurray's wax statue and the wheels spin. And it's the whole deal. I mean, this one. But also the most recent thing she has is Jimmy Stewart from the Movie Land Wax Museum. So she has Jimmy Stewart there with him in his cast. And she has the entire background that was there. I mean, like the furniture and everything that was on the shelves behind him. And the pictures of Jimmy Stewart there with, you know, with when he unveiled it. And I love wax museums anyway. It's like a fetish of mine. But I saw her on YouTube. She's got a channel called The Weird and the Wonderful. Her name's Cynthia Lazarus. And she said, yeah, come on and visit. And I walked in and I was like, she's got Linda Blair with her head spinning at her staircase. You know, she has the giant chariot from Ben-Hur in her family room. You know, upstairs she has like the Marx Brothers. I mean, like the entire Marx Brothers. It's insane. And she has like Elvira's wedding dress, like Cassandra Peterson. And I wish you could sit. It's like It's it's unbelievable. Yeah, wow. She's hilarious. She's funny. She's sweet, and she collects wax museums. Literally a wax museum. So
wow.
Yeah.
So check out that YouTube channel. What was it again?
Yeah, Weird and Wonderful. Yeah,
Weird she's and Wonderful. Great.
Well, if you go to my Dearly Departed Tours, you'll find that's my last video, and you can go. It's linked to her, and you'll see it. It's just she's so sweet.
Cool.
She's amazing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So. Yeah.
Is that all the hate mail?
I think. Oh yeah, that's all my hate mail. That's all my.
Hate mail. Okay. all right. Well, do we want to get into the main feature?
I think we should.
It's time for the main feature.
All right. It is Universal Monsters is our theme of this episode. The great monster movies of the 1930s from Universal Studios. Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, the Dracula, Wolfman, the other Frankenstein sequels that came out that decade. And were just a huge, huge, huge success for Universal in the 30s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, Phantom of the Opera. I mean, they're so yeah. It just goes. It's. I love the Universal monsters. I mean, you know, it made them, and it really put them on the map. I think the monsters did. And as I said in our Patreon episode that we recorded a little bit earlier for the people that subscribe to the channel, they. You know, the Universal kind of just blew off the monsters. You know, they didn't really acknowledge it. When you went to Universal Studios, you never saw it was all, you know, it was all whatever was recent. You know, though now it's all Harry Potter junk. But now you'll see Battle of the Ghosts there and you'll see, you know, things like that. Yeah. Whereas before, they really wasn't anything that they ever really thought to embrace. So,
well. A few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I don't know how long it was, they tried to reboot their classical monster franchises, and they did a Tom Cruise movie with The Mummy, and it was not good. It was not
Tom
good.
Cruise?
And can you believe you that's how great it did. You don't even remember it that it happened. Yeah, it was called I think it was just The Mummy. It wasn't like the Brendan Fraser ones. It was
I remember now. I forgot about that. I did see that. And
it was 2017. And Russell Crowe was in it. And it was, I don't like to dog other people's movies cause I make movies too. And so I try not to be critical publicly, but it was not good. It was not good. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of a mess and it didn't do well. And that was kind of the end of it. I don't think they're going to, I mean, if they do try to get that going again, it won't be the whatever direction they were going, I think at that time. So yeah, it was not great. It was weird. It was like overly serious. And I don't know. It wasn't fun like the Brendan Fraser Mummy movies that were kind of like, you know, Indiana Jones type things.
Yeah.
It was set in modern times and yeah, it was weird.
Yeah. So yeah, something that Tom Cruise didn't turn to gold. And,
which normally, whatever, say what you will about him, he usually picks really good projects and there's always, the screenplays are always good. He's got a good track record. He doesn't usually make bad stuff. So
yeah
it was a rare misfire. So what do you want to start with?
Well, let's go into Frankenstein. I know it's not the first, but Frankenstein is the first on my list.
so that's director James Whale
again. Yeah, and produced by Carl Amelie. But James Whale, who we haven't talked about him before, have we? We talked about Todd Browning, but not James Whale, have we?
I don't. We may have mentioned him in passing before, but no, I don't know that we've ever dove in.
Okay. Well, I mean, James Whale was he directed Frankenstein. He directed Bride of Frankenstein. He did like horror movies.
Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
another one called The Old Dark House.
He was. He was something else, and that film that they made about him was really interesting. If you ever got a chance to see it, it's being a Brendan Fraser. It was called Gods and Monsters.
Really good film.
Yeah, with, I really like that a lot.
Ian McKellen plays Whale, and Fraser plays a fictionalized gardener character working at Whale's house. And when Whale is, you know, his career is basically over. He's an old man. And whale was a very rare bird for his time. He was openly gay, and mm-hmm. and had a live-in companion, David Lewis, who lived together for over 20 years, and it was open. Everybody knew about it, which back then it was almost unheard of. And David Lewis, his partner, was Irving Thalberg's assistant. Irving Thalberg, one of my favorite people in Hollywood history, who was the head of production for MGM, and one of the early. I mean, Irving Thalberg mm-hmm. was a major early force in the film industry, and the Producers Guild every year still gives out an Irving Thalberg award that is dedicated in his honor. But David Lewis, who was James Whale's partner, was Irving Thalberg's assistant. I mean, drove him around, would hang out with him at his house, and then James Whale was, a director. So,
mm-hmm.
and then later on, after Thalberg died, a lot of people that had been kind of protected by Thalberg kind of had to find somewhere else to go. And David Lewis was one of those guys, I think. But David Lewis went on to be a producer in his own right and produced films, I think, into the 60s. So, or at least the 50s.
So yeah. James Whale died in 57, May 29th, 1957, by drowning in his swimming pool. And, and it was a suicide. It was, they said it was accidental, but shortly before his boyfriend died, said he stumbled on a note and said that basically, it was, or he didn't stumble on it, he had it the whole time. He just didn't release what the note said, but it was a suicide note.
Yeah, I think Whale had asked not to be released until he was dead or something like that. Yeah, it was kept secret for a long time.
Yeah. So it was funny because I was watching the Academy Awards, it had to be about 20 years ago now. And Goldie Hawn was giving out a reward, an award, or receiving one. I think she was presenting an award, and the subject of Frankenstein came up, and James Whale came up, and she goes, "Oh, I live in his house. He drowned in my swimming pool." And and it was Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell ended up buying James Whale's house that he drowned in. It's just kind of a. It was just kind of a. It wasn't thing. Something actually, she didn't say he drowned in her pool, but I just. But she did say I live in the house where he lived, and I just knew it. But it was. It's kind of funny.
I think that the house is still around too. I believe too. Yeah, it's nice.
It's in the Palisades.
House.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was a cool little house, and it's just. I don't think they still live in it, but they did.
Basically, what's wild with Whale is he's a good example of. It seemed to be especially true in the early days of Hollywood. He was red hot for like 5 or 6 years with Universal, and then the bottom just falls out. He has like kind of one not good film, and there's the old saying in Hollywood, you're only as good as the last thing you did, and it's crazy how fast you can kind of fall off that wagon and not be hot anymore. And his career was basically over by the 40s. So yeah, it's really wild. And then he had a series of serious health issues, and that's what his suicide note referenced, was just that he was in almost constant agony, basically, because all his health issues. So
and only 67 years old. Yeah, that's sad. It's it was a fascinating movie that was, and it was really well
Gods
done.
And Monsters.
Really well done. Yeah. I'd love to, like, Elsa Lanchester's character was in there, Charles Laughton character, and it was just, that whole 30s movie, horror movie, people just being normal people. It was so cool. I liked it.
Right. So James, he passed away on May 29th, 1957. By then, he and Lewis had separated, and he dated several other young men, which is kind of what... Brendan Fraser, I think, is kind of an amalgamation of the kind of 20-something, young guys that were around Whale toward the end.
I didn't realize they broke up. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Because Whale, I guess, went, after his career kind of cratered, he went to France for a while and came back to the U.S. with the French waiter, I think, that he met over there. And Lewis obviously was not okay with that. And so that was Lewis moved out, and that was kind of the end of it. But I think he and Lewis stayed close. I remained close friends for years afterwards, but yeah, weren't together anymore. I also thought this was very interesting. Whale, one of his early gigs, he worked on Hell's Angels, the Howard Hughes film. He was Gene Harlow's dialogue coach.
Oh, interesting.
And is kind of an uncredited director because Hell's Angels famously was, they started making it when they were still doing silent films. And then all of a sudden talkies became the rage and they were still working on the movie. And they were like, we got to make this thing into a sound movie. And so they needed a guy. They suddenly needed directors who had stage directing experience, which is where James Whale had come from. He had directed plays in London and on Broadway. So he came in as a quote dialogue coach to basically direct all the new scenes that they were doing that had dialogue in them. And so they needed people that had experience directing actors who were actually speaking, I guess, which most film directors at the time never had to deal with.
Yeah.
So it was all pantomime, you know?
Was he from England originally?
I believe he was British. Yeah.
Cause I wonder what kind of dialogue he taught.
He had good British diction.
Yeah. That actor land accent.
Yep. In fact, I think it was him. I think he had fought in World War I and had been captured and was it him? I think it had been captured and had been a POW for a number of years or for however time during World War I.
World War I broke out in August 1914, had little interest in politics, realizing stationed in Bristol, subsequently commissioned second lieutenant in Worcestershire, taken prisoner of war in battle at the Western Front in Flanders in 1917, and was held at the officer's camp, and he stayed there until the end of the war, like a little over a year. Huh.
And it was while he was a POW that he became interested in drama, because the POWs, to pass the time, would do, you know, stage productions and stuff, and I think that's where he discovered that he liked to do that, and that started his career.
And I think Carl Lamley wanted Whale right away, didn't he, to do the directing for the horror movies. I'm pretty sure that Lamley is the one. 1931, Universal chief Carl Lamley offered Whale his choice of any property. So, and Whale chose Frankenstein. So, interesting, but, right. But great. And it was 1931 it was made. Those movies, I was watching, I think you watched them too. I watched Dracula, I watched Frankenstein, I watched Phantom of the Opera. It was like hour 10 minutes, hour long. You know, it was like.
They're nice and short. They're like 70 minutes, 75 minutes. I love it.
Yeah. I went to see that James Bond movie. It was 2 hours, 40 minutes at that new James Bond movie. It was like, oh my God. I'm not going to say I was bored, but it was like, oh my God. You could say a lot in a lot less time, you know?
Right. And they did back. Well, you know, film was expensive, so you want to keep it short back then when you could.
Right.
The silent era, there were some crazy, like, 4 hour long plus long epics.
That's true. That original one that was done by Eric von Stroheim.
Intolerance and greed and intolerance.
Greed,
and all
that's what it was. Yeah. It was like 10 hours or something. Yeah.
Which, you want to talk about things going slow, a movie that's that long with no dialogue.
Yeah, and also it's funny because Nosferatu is, riffing on the Dracula thing a little bit. I found that really hard to sit through. We've talked about that. Silent movies are a little bit rough for me. But if you watch Nosferatu on fast forward, it's perfect. You know, you could read all the cards and you're not missing any of the action. And it's great. So just watch it on fast forward. Half the time you get the movie and it works.
Yeah.
Nosferatu was a good movie too, but better when it's fast forwarded in my mind.
Also, what was really interesting about these, if you're a film nerd, what was really interesting about the Universal horror films was the influence of German Expressionism on the look. The severe, you know, the strong shadows, the severe contrast between dark and light images on the screen, you know, just severe lighting, really expressionistic and interesting. I mean, if you want like a more modern example, you know, early Tim Burton stuff, like Tim Burton's Batman movies are a good example of that. Just really wild shapes and contrasty and moody.
And well, I mean, really well done, because you know that a lot of it was matte, you know, the background were matte, but considering the time period they did it in, I mean, there was something I noticed, like, wow, these sets, you know, everything is really good. Now, granted, you know, black and white is an art form because of the lighting, et cetera, and you have to say so much more with less information as far as color goes, because, you know, it doesn't translate as well. And you do have an appreciation for the artistry for something like that, because they were stunning movies,
practical in camera effects, as they say. Yeah, you know, one thing that I speaking of that, one thing that jumped out to me was I watched The Bride of Frankenstein this week, and there's a scene where there's like little miniature people in glass jars.
Oh yeah.
I was like, I don't totally know how they did that back then, because that was like 1936 or 35. I know how they did it, but I don't know how they did it. Like today, you could do it in a day. It would be easy. You just green screen it. It was so well done. It was really well done. So it looked very real for its time. The way they did that. I just kept watching it. Like, was very impressed.
It was mesmerizing. Yeah.
I also loved The Bride of Frankenstein. I think I liked it more than the original film. Cause it was fun.
Yeah, it was campy. It was campy. Yeah. I was surprised at how campy it was, actually. You know, it was a lot more lighthearted and less sinister. I mean, Frankenstein had full dialogue. I mean, you know, and he was just, you know, within the span of like a day, he learned, you know, how to have conversations. Right. And I learned how to smoke and all this kind of silly stuff. So
it's funny. People talk about camp, and obviously that's part of it. But I also wonder if it wasn't the fact that screwball comedies took off in the early 30s, know, after the, you know, the first Frankenstein came out. And I wonder if that didn't play some part in it, because it was kind of like over the top comedy a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It was broad. So, yeah. And it's funny. I thought about it, like Young Frankenstein, the film, the Mel Brooks film, is much more Bride of Frankenstein than Frankenstein, than the original film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And another one was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. You know, that's the Frankenstein story, basically. And it's more Bride than it is Frankenstein. Frankenstein was a serious movie. It was a horrifying movie. And Bride, you know, it was a bit more... It was like probably the first sequel they ever did, you know, and
it's almost like what they did with Gremlins 2. They just went for it on the second movie. You know what I mean? Like, let's just have fun and do crazy stuff with it. Yeah.
So, so it's based on the novel by Mary Shelley, and Mary Shelley, it was interesting, in the credits, they billed her as Mrs. Percy Shelley, not Mary Shelley. So she went by her husband's name. She was married to Percy, the philosopher and the poet. And he died, he was like drowned in a ship. Accident is like his body washed up like 10 days later and like Rome or something. And they ended up cremating him there, but his heart didn't burn. So they left his body in Italy, I believe, is where he washed up, and gave his heart to Mary Shelley. They said it was calcified or something like that. So Mary Shelley's buried in Bournemouth in England with her husband's heart. Just as hard, because it's interesting, because she was so, Frankenstein came out of this woman's brain. So,
right.
You know, she's clearly thinking pretty bizarre, you know, manner. So, and she died in 1851 of a brain tumor. But it's interesting. And they didn't even give her name when she, you know, when in the movie it was Mrs., you know, Percy B. Shelley, not Mary Shelley. So it's just fascinating for that time period.
We're talking about Frankenstein. You want to talk about Boris Karloff?
Yeah. Not a single line of dialogue, just a lot of grunts and a lot of, couldn't even tell, you know, couldn't even know it was who it was. Didn't even get a credit, did he?
Right. Yeah, it's just in the opening credits, it just says the monster and with a question mark next to it. Whereas, of course, all the other actors were credited next to their names, their character names. I also thought it was interesting that in The Bride of Frankenstein, 4 years later, they credited the monster as just Karloff. his last name only. And then for the monster's mate, they did the same thing with the question mark. They didn't give Elsa Lanchester a credit in that either.
But she did get one because she played Mary Shelley at the beginning.
I totally didn't pick up on that either.
It was her and Percy, her husband, and someone else sitting around in a parlor, and she was doing needlepoint or something and talking about, you know, come on, you know, Mary, you've got some story, or, you know, and then she goes into the bride, but that goes into the
movie.
They
did a weird, like, recap, kind of like what today would be like, you know, on the last episode, just to catch audiences up on what happened in the first movie, just in case you didn't see the first movie, you'd know what was going on, kind of deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really funny.
Yeah. I think it was it 5 years from the original one that they did? I believe it was Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein was done in 35.
So
41 was the original. So it was about a 40. And they still had, I think they still had the original props laying around. So they were still able to use the sets from that.
And speaking of Karloff, his apparently each one of his shoes for Frankenstein's monster was, I think they had like 4-inch soles on them. Each one, I think, weighed like 11 pounds. And it took him hours and hours and hours to get into makeup. And I think he ended up later in his career being a real advocate. You know, we talked earlier about, you know, on the set and how crews are treated and stuff. I think he became an advocate later on for, you know, hours, because he had to spend so many hours in makeup to get all that stuff put on him. And it was just like, it was a lot to ask of a person, I think, is what it came down to. So he kind of became an advocate for actors' rights and time, how much time they spend on sets, and how, you know, you go through 6-7 hours of makeup before you even start acting.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. He became famous for not having a single line. Of course, you know, in Bride of Frankenstein came about, he had complete, you know, dialogue. I mean, he knew how to,
he learned
within
how to talk.
A day, you know, he could talk about everything. Wife, smoke, you know.
And what's really, what I find ironic is that, you know, we're going to talk about Bela Lugosi in a bit. You know, Bela Lugosi had the thick Hungarian accent, which actually kept him from getting a lot of roles. Other roles in his career, because a lot of times he was difficult to understand his English, and yet he gets all the speaking parts with the Dracula character, and Boris Karloff, who's British and has excellent diction, gets a monster that doesn't talk.
That was kind of odd. It is funny. And I don't know how realistic that rivalry was between the two of them. You know, I think that Bela wanted more parts. I think they say Bela was offered or refused. It was refused Frankenstein. I think that's what it was, that Bela Lugosi claimed he had head was offered to it. But yeah, Bela Lugosi, but they say that Bela and Boris Karloff had a feud because they're both, you know, horror film stars. But,
at Universal, and Frankenstein and Dracula came out the same year. So, yeah, you can kind of see how it would have come from. And I guess they got along more or less okay, at least for a time. I don't know. But, you know, Boris Karloff ended up having the far better career in the long run than Lugosi did, I think.
So. More, yes, certainly, yeah. And there was the way it was represented in the movie Ed Wood was quite funny. The way that he referred to, you know, Karloff, that cocksucker. it was pretty funny. I love that. But yeah, so Karloff, though, good on him. So he and Bela were, you know, were sort of neck and neck. He was in The Walking Dead in 36. He was in The Invisible Ray in 36. He ended up, both of them ended up doing like spoofy Abbott and Costello movies, you know, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which is a connection to the murder of Robert Lees, you know, the guy, the little screenwriter that got murdered in Hollywood, got his head cut off by the hustler. He was a screenwriter for Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And
and Lugosi and Karloff were both together in Son of Frankenstein, right?
I think so. Yeah.
They were both in
I think
that
so.
Together. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. They,
someone
I mean,
finally
so
had the idea,
of those.
Let's put them together.
There's so many of those outrageous, you know, comedy. They, after a while, they just didn't care. You know, they're like, put the Wolfman in there. You know, it was a teenage Wolfman. You know, do that. You know, Godzilla versus Frankenstein. Yeah, do that. And it just didn't matter after a while. They just went and did their thing. And then he went on to have quite a success in as a voice actor too.
Yeah, he's the Grinch.
Yeah, the Grinch Who Stole Christmas, and he ended up doing a lot of silly movies too. He was in The Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, where he had, his character name was like the Ghoul or something like that. And it's interesting because we talked about in the Patreon episode, Tommy Kirk, the Disney kid, was in that movie as well. The one that just died not that long ago. But Grinch Stole Christmas. Yeah, he was the Grinch. Thurl Ravenscroft sang the song. He was the guy that was Tony the Tiger, which is pretty cool.
Oh, really?
Cool. They're great. Yeah, Thurl Ravenscroft. And I think he was Captain Crunch too.
And, oh, wow.
I love that. But yeah, and he was doing some kind of silly movies towards the end, you know, beach movies, because a lot of them were. I remember that Buster Keaton, he was doing them too. Beach movies, you know, just kind of trash, throwaway, I've got a week to kill movies. And but anyway, he ended up, Boris Karloff ended up passing away in February of 69. He was 81. And
he apparently was a heavy smoker, and he only had like half of a functioning lung yet left at the end. And so he died from pneumonia, basically. So
okay.
When you have half of a functioning lung, you don't want to get pneumonia. And that was the end.
Yeah. He was cremated, and his ashes. Well, there's a plaque for him at the Actors Church in London in Covent Garden. I think that's where his ashes are, in a wall, because there's a wall outside, but there's also a bench with his name on it. But that's where his cremains are, in the Actors Church in Covent Garden in London.
Wow.
And he was 81 years old. But it's interesting. We were talking about just a second ago, Richard O'Brien. I wrote a book about the Rocky Horror Picture Show several years ago. I interviewed, you know, most everyone that was involved with it. And Richard O'Brien, who wrote the story, you know, made it, of course, his own, was sued by a woman who claims that he stole her idea of, I don't know, a transvestite that comes from outer space. And, you know, I guess, but she sued him. And he ended up not having to go to court, because he's like, well, we both ripped off Mary Shelley. You know, if you wrote the story, we both owe our careers to Mary Shelley. So what are you even saying? But yeah, I thought it was a clever way to put it, because I never really thought of it that way. But there was some sort of, provenance or, you know, how you can get away with a lot of stuff with, like we talked about Elf, you know, how they did the Rankin Bass stuff. It wasn't even just, it was just straight up, here are your props. You're basically remaking the props. And, and that's what they were doing. So that's interesting. Interesting. But I guess Frankenstein's probably public domain now anyway, the novel.
Yeah, that's I think why a lot of those, why they went back and dove into those books from the 1800s, because they were public domain, and there was no one to pay for the rights.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Disney kind of did the same thing with some of their early movies, similar situation.
Oh, yeah.
Doing like old fairy tale stuff. Well, since we're talking about Frankenstein, might as well mention Elsa Lanchester, right?
Sure. Yeah.
She was the bride in Bride of Frankenstein. I thought she was great in it. I have to mention, she is in my favorite Christmas movie that I mention, seems like every other episode. She was the housekeeper in The Bishop's Wife with David Niven and Loretta Young and Cary Grant. Yep. It's a sizable role.
A fascinating lady. I know. I love her. Because the choices she made, you know, granted, maybe she didn't have a lot of choices, and she ended up taking a lot of horror movie roles after The Bride of Frankenstein. That's clearly not, but she played housekeeper roles too. You know, it's another one of those British, you know, sturdy women, you know, for lack of a better term. Well, it's the only term I could think of that were often cast. She was a Mary Poppins as a housekeeper. And
housekeeper.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like the butler thing, you know, it's just that they're British and, you know, stick them in a kitchen. but yeah. So, and she was married to Charles Laughton, who famously played the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Yeah, and so it was in, I think, 1927 that was made.
Well, but, or was he in? Was he in the 1939 version, or is in the
39? No, you're right. You're right. It's 39. He played Quasimodo. It was 27. Was the first time it was done. The silent version.
Apparently, Elsa and Charles Laughton were in 12 films together.
That many, eh? Okay.
Which is wild.
Interesting.
And also, Laughton is also famous for, he basically helped launch the career of Maureen O'Hara. Hmm. She was in a Hitchcock film, I think Jamaica Inn, and Laughton was impressed by her. And basically, when Laughton came over to do The Hunchback, he kind of insisted that they cast Maureen O'Hara, who was like 18 or 19, as Esmeralda. And that was it. The rest was history. Her stardom took off from there.
Yeah, I like Charles Laughton's a fascinating character. He was. And and my God, the Night of the Hunter, you know, that movie is probably the most visually insane movie ever made. Yeah. It's the only movie I think he ever directed, I believe.
He
was sort of laughed out of the theater when it was
kind of overlooked when it came out. Now it's considered a total classic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a disaster. I think as long as he lived, it was a disastrous movie. But right. Oh my God, it's so scary as hell. It is a really good movie, mm-hmm. and it looks amazing. You know, it looks like Tim Burton's probably borrowed a lot of that too, because but it's all live action. But the imagery, those little kids running away from that sinister preacher, and oh, that's a good movie. That is a scary as hell movie. That thing, did we talk about this before? Yeah, we did with the Poseidon Adventure episode. We were talking about Shelley Winters in the movie, how she's killed and she's at the bottom of the lake in a car tied up. And then they show her at the bottom of the lake with the seaweed in her hair.
Right.
Oh, man. That was, and then you see a fish hook go by her head.
Fishing lure go by.
It was insane. That was a great movie, but. Anyway, so that was Charles Laughton, but Elsa Lanchester, and he had an acting school in Hollywood, and they taught Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe took acting lessons.
Oh,
from
wow.
Them,
I did not know that.
Which is kind of interesting. Yeah. Their house was right off of, where that old abandoned house was off Sierra Bonita, where the James Dean house is, that just across that park, is where their house was. But anyway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, Elsa Lanchester passed away on January 5th, 1987. She was 84. And Charles Laughton, her husband, had passed away 2 decades earlier. He died December 15th, 1962. He was only 63. He died from renal cancer.
There was a story that came out on him Well, Scotty Bowers wrote that book, Full Service. It's a really trashy book. He said he was like a pimp.
Right.
And what he said about Charles Laughton, it was insane. It was stuff about, you know, like Nutella. I'll leave it at that.
It involved
stuff
Nutella.
Like Nutella.
Use your imagination.
But he was famously, he was gay. And she found out about it. Apparently, the story is, or the legend is, that she walked home. She came home and found him on a sofa with a young man, and she threw the sofa out the window and never spoke about it again. That's the legend.
Sure.
Now there, I think she wrote an autobiography and mentions it there about his homosexuality. So,
well, I read some that she tried in her book. She tried to blame the fact that she never had kids on the fact that he was gay. But then other people that were close with him said no, he was actually bi, and the reason that she didn't have kids was either because she didn't want to or because of medical issues that she had. So I don't know what the real issue was, but.
Yeah, it's an interesting marriage for sure.
Yeah.
And she had, and I love that her choices. Though she did an amazing episode of the Night Gallery, that Rod Serling show, where she, mm-hmm. With green, literally like fingers that were plants. And Willard, she played the crazy mother in Willard, mm-hmm. the rat movie. I love that. She was in Murder by Death, which if you haven't seen Murder by Death, that was made in 1976. And it has all these old, now, like Maggie Smith and David Niven played old detective. Peter Lorre played Sam Spade. I mean, Peter Peter Falk played Sam Spade, and Charlie Chan was played by Peter Sellers. All these, you know, and she played Miss Marple, I think it was. I think it was like an Agatha Christie thing, too. Anyway, it was a great movie, this a very, very funny movie. Truman Capote, Nancy Walker, one of those all-star casts. Anyway, the point, that I think you probably just delete all that shit. What I found, what was interesting, this was something I found about Elsa Lanchester and her hair in Bride of Frankenstein, the famous Hostess Cupcake hairdo, you know?
Yeah.
And I found a couple of quotes about it, and she said, oh, shit. Alexa, stop.
Alexa, so I found a couple, stop. I found... Stop, Alexa. No, stop.
I found a couple of quotes about her and her hair. And she said it was accomplished by combing it over a wire mesh cage. And she said it was extremely painful, and her eyes were kept taped wide open for the long takes.
I always assumed it was a wig. Why would they do that to her real hair?
Imagine it was hair pieces, but it was like, you know, it was a cage basically.
It had to be stitched together, hair. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
But she said the most memorable thing I did in that film, I believe, was my screaming. In all my movies since, I've been called upon to scream. I don't know if it's by chance, but I'd like to think that I'm not hired for that talent alone. And she says, it annoys me when mothers drag their poor dears to me and demand the children say something to Frankenstein's bride. Can you imagine an actress being overexposed by a picture she made 40 years ago?
Mm.
Okay. Some people would kill for that, and and literally kill for that. And on her marriage to Charles Laughton, she said, we both needed other company. I met his young man. This is something I guess she said. So I met his young men, and I had a young man around that Charles didn't even argue about.
Oh, so interesting.
Apparently, it was well known to them both. Eventually, you know, you're just going to whatever, you know, that's, I guess. But yeah. She
all
said,
right.
She'll be back to Charles Laughton said, I have a face that would stop a sundial. That's funny. That's very funny.
He did have an odd face. That is for sure.
Yeah.
So you want to move on to Dracula?
Thing that's kind of interesting to talk about. This is something that should be, and I think it relates to Dracula well. So it's a good it's a good segue.
All right.
Dwight Frye, who played Fritz in Frankenstein, was the guy who played Renfield in Dracula.
Both kind of sidekicks to villain-ish like characters, but very, very physically very different performances, which is, and it's in the same year he did those two movies.
Yeah.
It's crazy. He's in both.
Yeah. It's very interesting. So he was, and also I'm sure we're going to get flack because we call Boris Karloff Frankenstein, but it's actually the Frankenstein monster. It was Dr. Frankenstein. Right. So we're aware of that.
Although if you ever watched the movie, there is at least one instance where they refer to him as Frankenstein, I believe. Not just the monster.
It works for me. Frankenstein,
but that is a common mistake that people make. Dr. Frankenstein is the doctor who created Frankenstein's monster, which is the monster. Yeah. But everybody just calls
him Frankenstein. Now known as Frankenstein.
Just accept that we all call the monster Frankenstein. Everybody.
If you look it up, Google Frankenstein, you're not going to get Colin Clive. You're going to get Boris Karloff, you know?
Right. You're not going to get a Colin Clive Halloween mask. You're going to get a Boris Karloff Halloween mask, all right?
Damn right. So Dwight Frye, he played Renfield in Dracula, played Fritz in Frankenstein. He was also in The Invisible Man and in The Bride of Frankenstein.
Wow.
And he was never called Igor. Igor was a word, I think, that came out of the Shelley novel. It was never used ever in any of the films. So, you know, it's always an Igor name, but that was in the Mary Shelley book, not in any movies.
That's interesting. Yeah, I noticed they called him Fritz, and I thought that was odd because he seemed like the Igor type character, but they didn't call him.
Yeah, and then Young Frankenstein, it's Igor. So
why wouldn't they? Why would they change that? I wonder.
But apparently Dwight Fry died on a bus in Hollywood.
Yeah, I believe he was riding. He had been to the movies with, I think, his son maybe or something, and they were riding a bus coming home. And yeah, he had a heart attack.
I went on a deep dive looking for that, and I couldn't find anything. It said that he died on a bus, and I went through all the 1943 papers, and it mentions that he died, you know, of a heart attack, but it doesn't tell you doesn't tell you that it was on a, you know, he's pronounced dead,
right.
I believe, at the Hollywood Hospital, which is now the Wilcox Police Station. That's where it was. Same place Fred Mertz was pronounced dead.
Yeah, he was only 44, and he had apparently had a heart condition, he just had a heart attack. Man, you know, and this is like a recurring theme, and it's going to come up again in this episode, is young people, especially young actors, youngish at least, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, who you would think are, you know, in fit condition, and just, I think it's just the a result of the era that they were in, just so many like serious heart and health issues that a lot of these actors had that they seems like,
I mean,
they
were probably taking, you know,
youngish.
Mercury cocktails and asbestos, right. You know, the costumes, you
there
know.
Was, yeah, the costumes were horrible for them to make up. I mean, there's all the famous makeup from The Wizard of Oz, and the incidents they had with that. But also just there was really no health and fitness science, at least not in the way that we know it today. And people just drank heavily and smoked heavily and their bodies were just ripped up. It's like they aged faster because the way they lived. And then there are also, I think, there were a lot of like serious health conditions that aren't as big of a deal now that we've kind of learned to deal with that they had no answer to back then, too, on top of that. So, yeah.
And mental health issues, too, that were just, get over it kind of thing. Like Colin Clive, you know, Colin Clive was a guy that was just destroyed by drinking. And
if we want to talk about Colin Clive. Let's
sure. Yeah. I don't. I mean, I don't have a lot of information about him,
around.
But
I really wanted to talk about him because he was kind of a fascinating character. Of course, he's Dr. Frankenstein. He's famous for the, you know, it's alive. It's alive. Famous quote when Frankenstein monster, you know, comes alive. You know, he's talking about how he knows what it's like to be a god, which is what Frankenstein's kind of all about. Right. Man pretending to be God. And then it backfiring on him. So he apparently had tuberculosis and then was a pretty bad alcoholic, and it was what his alcohol issues were well known. I guess it was always passing out on set, you know, when they weren't rolling. And I even saw, I don't know if this is true, but I saw one claim that like when they would go to do over the shoulder shots on him, there were times when he had to be held up practically to stand in the shot. He's just a kind of a fall down drunk alcoholic, unfortunately. And he had tuberculosis on top of that. So that's a bad combination. And he passed away in 1937, which was just 2 years after Bride of Frankenstein. So he was only 37 years old himself. And I guess Peter Lorre was one of his pallbearers.
Yeah, I think he was at Under McKinley on Hollywood Boulevard, which is where Bella, which is where the Fritz guy, Dwight Fry, and, you know, Criswell, and all those guys were all buried out of that mortuary.
So here's what I heard. I correct me if I'm wrong, but he was cremated at Chapel of the Pines.
Oh, was he? Okay, so that
makes
sense.
I don't
know
where the memorial was held, though. I mean, I don't think the memorial was held at the crematorium, but so it might have been.
Right.
I don't know. But here's what's weird. So 300 people show up at his funeral and then he wasn't buried. He was cremated, and apparently his cremains sat in the basement of the crematorium for 40 years.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 1978 that they were finally like, we should do something with this guy. And they went and scattered him at sea. But he sat there for over 40 years. And apparently the reason that I read is, or the speculation is, that he was married back in England before he moved to the U.S. And when he came to Hollywood, he left his wife behind. And they, I think, were separated by this point. And then I think he had girlfriends or whatever out here. And so the only person that could legally take possession of his cremains was his wife. And they were separated and estranged, and I guess she didn't want him or didn't want to go through the hassle of bringing him back to England or whatever, and so no one claimed him or could legally claim them but her, and that was it. And you've run into those situations when you do the headstones for people trying to get permission right?
Yeah. So, yeah, at Chapel of the Pines, that was mostly a crematorium. You know, now they mm-hmm. have burials, or columbariums is when they bury ashes, you know, so they have a lot of that around there now. But underneath it is storage, and there are thousands of people underneath there in boxes with names on them. And to get, you know, there are a lot of actors down there. One of the people we were looking for was Steven Stucker, who played Johnny in Airplane. You know, mm-hmm. I can make a brooch, I can make a pterodactyl.
Yeah, yeah.
He was down there for many years, too. And you have to go through a legal process to get them out, because you have to prove there's no next of kin. Anne Sheridan is another actress. My friend Karen McHale went through that whole legal process. They did find someone that was a next of kin to sign the paperwork to have that person removed from basically a shelf in the basement, and then presented to this family member who then mm-hmm. they buried or put her in a columbarium at Hollywood Cemetery. So yeah, there's a long, exhausting process that you have to go through legally to get somebody's cremains.
And I guess, you know, it's once you do it, if you scatter someone at sea, you can't undo that. So if they get it wrong, yeah, that's a big lawsuit, I'm sure. So they got to make sure that, you know, they dot their I's and cross their T's. And apparently at the Chapel of the Pines crematorium, there's a cenotaph to Colin Clive there.
Oh, is there? I have to go look. Okay.
There's a marker, but he's not buried there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And coincidentally, in the cemetery that's kind of next door, as I think where Todd Browning is buried. There's like a mausoleum there.
That's right. Angela's Rosedale. Yeah. And we didn't talk about, so James Whale, Frankenstein director, he's buried at Forest Lawn, Glendale. Dwight Frye, who played Renfield and Fritz, he's buried at Forest Lawn, Glendale. Elsa Lanchester, who played the bride, died at the Motion Picture Country Home and was scattered at sea. Charles Laughton, the Hunchback of Notre Dame or Notre Dame, is buried full burial at Forest Lawn, Hollywood Hills. So they're all over the place. And Colin Clive, scattered. You said, he's in the basement, but he has a cenotaph. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. He's still in storage.
No, yeah, they he was Clive was finally scattered at sea in the 70s, but there's a cenotaph for him at the crematorium.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
It's wild, right?
Yeah, very, very, very.
It's amazing that 300 people show up at his funeral, but then no one is there to take his ashes and actually bury him. It's like they all were just like, well, I guess that's getting taken care of. So I'll go home now.
Some people, I guess they just don't care. But some people just don't care.
Or when you go to a funeral, the family is handling all of that. So you're not thinking about it, I guess.
Somebody paid for the cremation.
Yeah.
Unless that's the reason that he's there. Because there's a lot of people that just haven't paid the bill and they're in storage. So that might be part of it too. Because he was 37. and those people were not making a whole lot of money. I think Elsa Lanchester, I looked it up. She got paid for Bride of Frankenstein $2,500. That was it. Right. Now, today's money, I did a comparison. It's $52,000 today. But that's with no royalties, no residuals, nothing. Right. Just $52,000, and she's typecast for the rest of her life.
And that's why
interesting.
That's why a lot of them, like Bela Lugosi, could get destitute pretty fast.
Yeah.
Even though you think they're these huge stars raking in all this money, they weren't, you know, if you weren't at that top A-list level, you were just making enough to live comfortably, but not enough to, I guess, unless you were really smart with your money, to save it up so that you could survive the lean years, you know?
Yeah. Unless you got a piece of the production, you know?
Right.
For sure.
Yep.
Because, Bella especially, I mean, having no really other career aside from Dracula, you couldn't look at him and not see Dracula. So it really ruined him. It really ruined him.
So Lugosi was both not only ruined by being typecasted, but also just, we talked about this earlier, his accent and his English wasn't always very clear. It hindered his career going forward. The speaking mm-hmm. parts he wanted to get. In fact, one of his later films, they actually dubbed over him, which was very bad for his career. Because he had the Hungarian accent, he had immigrated to the U.S. from Hungary by way of, I think, Germany en route, mm-hmm. and kind of was run out of Hungary and was married to a Hungarian woman. And they kind of fled the country together because the political situation changed in the country. But then she didn't want to leave her parents behind. So they ended up divorcing and she moved back to Hungary. So again, like so many of these stars from that era, I think he was married, you know, multiple times over the years to various people.
Yeah, he had a lot of success. I mean, he was a really wealthy man at one point.
Right.
You know, but they ended up dying in this crappy little apartment building, one bedroom, you know, off of Western in Hollywood.
With parts in Ed Wood movies. You know, that was how it ended.
Yeah.
But his role as Dracula, go watch that movie today. It is what we think of as Dracula is what he did. Like, he almost like created the mold of the Dracula character with the accent and the hair and makeup and every. I mean, it's when kids dress up as Dracula for Halloween, they're dressing up as Bela Lugosi's Dracula, basically. His interpretation.
Yeah, for sure. You know? And there was, some of it was pretty, it's pretty laughable, you know, some of it. I don't want to just, you know, it wasn't even just acting. It was just him staring. That's all it was. He moved.
Right. You know? With the really cool lighting just on the eyes. Lighting.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. German expressionism, man.
Yeah. It was pretty campy. I think in that regard, it's kind of funny when he has this that kind of just staring for 30 seconds, you know. I understand the intensity of it in the cinema when you saw it for the very first time. It's just in retrospect, when you're watching it on your television in your living room, it's a little bit of a snort when you see it, you know.
And when we did our Freaks episode, we mentioned that Todd Browning, when he wanted to do Dracula, but he wanted Lon Chaney to play Dracula. Mm-hmm. And that was the plan. But then the year before they made Dracula, Chaney died unexpectedly. He was only 47 years old, had a throat hemorrhage after getting a lung cancer diagnosis. And so Chaney really, Lugosi was not Chaney or was not Todd Browning's first choice, but he went with him mm-hmm. anyways. And of course, you know, it became the role that defined the rest of Lugosi's life.
Yeah. And he lived it too. I mean, he did that whole, you know, live in a castle-y kind of house thing and the big oil painting, and he was very grand and, it was very, I worked with a guy briefly in at the cemetery, at Hollywood Cemetery, back when I worked there for like 5 weeks in 2005. They wanted me to go door to door selling funerals, and it was awful. Mm. It was awful. I went to their whole school.
I think I remember the saying this. Yeah,
but you probably heard the story. So then the guy says, "Oh yeah, I live in Bella's old house up in Outlook." And he says, "Hey, I read a biography that he had like panthers buried in the backyard. So I went outside and found them. He went and dug them up, Bella's panthers. It was in this biography. And he went out inside because, yeah, I found them in the backyard.
Actual panthers?
Yeah, I think it was what it was. Either big holy dogs cow. Or panthers. But that was the way they were back then. You know, Mae West had a monkey. I know it's not the same thing. But it was a theater. Theta Bera, I think, had one too, but a leopard or something like that.
Right. Well, William Randolph Hearst had an entire zoo at his castle. So yeah, I guess it was a financial flex, I guess. I thought it was when you're speaking about Ed Wood and everything. The Ed Wood film, the one that Tim Burton did. I guess Lugosi's family took issue with some of the creative liberties that were taken with that, saying that Lugosi slept in a coffin, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
they're like he didn't.
I got a chance to talk to Martin Landau one time, who won the Oscar for playing Bela.
Yeah,
yeah. I got him to autograph my Ed Wood poster too to Dearly Departed, but that was cool. But anyway, I asked him about that. I said, "Did you what? You know, Bela Jr. You obviously Bela. You should say Bela. It's not Bela, but everyone says Bela." What did he have to say about it? And Bela Lugosi Jr., Bela's son, said, "I like everything about what you did, except Bela never had little dogs and he never swore." Was because he was pretty raunchy with the language. Not raunchy as in, just use some colorful words.
Sure.
And he said Bela would never do that. And he never had little chihuahuas or something like that. That was the only issues he took with it. But But he won an Oscar for playing Bela Lugosi, and Bela Lugosi never came within a mile of one.
Right.
So it's kind of funny.
The irony.
Poor Bela. So he was, I mean, also he was the first person to go, you know, really the first famous person to go into rehab, you know, that for coke, was a morphine addiction.
And, yeah, opiates. He apparently had a sciatica, which is, I had some issues with that. I think last year, extremely painful. The nerve down that goes through your hip bones and into your leg.
Down your whole leg, yeah.
It's really sharp, a really sharp, terrible pain. So he was given kind of stronger and stronger treatments for it until they got him on opiates, and then yeah, he became an addict. I didn't know about the rehab part though.
Yeah, there's pictures of him being checked into rehab on a hospital bed, looking very old and gaunt. But yeah, he I think it was a sanitarium is what they called it back then. But yeah, he admitted himself to it, and it was in all the papers. So he was like, he went public. And that's probably why no one would touch him after that. And that's how he got into Ed Wood movies, you know, because I'd met him on Hollywood Boulevard. You know, that's Bella's old stomping
grounds.
Talk
about that. Let's go into the Ed Wood stuff, because you kind of know a lot about that. And didn't we when we did Dearly Departed Volume 1, didn't we go into the cigar shop that he used to go to?
Yeah, which Hollywood is gone Boulevard. Now. Yeah, it's all boarded up and gone. So that's historic footage that we that is cool. It is. It really is. I mean, that was such a neat place. They had the cigar and the terrazzo out in front of it. And that was a neat, the Hollywood smoke shop. So yeah, Bela lived over on Western and interestingly, not very far from Vampira, where she ended up dying, like literally like three blocks from there. But Bela, every day of his life, would walk down Hollywood Boulevard to this cigar store and buy himself a cigar. And that's about the time he met up with Ed Wood. And the funeral home where Bela was laid out in his Dracula costume, and not because he chose it, because it's the nicest thing they had. His wife and his son chose it. Not in his cape, though, just the suit. The cape actually got auctioned off a few years ago, and it's going to go in the Academy Museum next year, I think. They're going to show that. But anyway, so at his funeral, Utter McKinley Mortuary, which was across from the Pantages Theater and the Hollywood Smoke Shop, now is the W Hotel, the Utter McKinley Mortuary, who handled Peg Entwistle, who jumped up the Hollywood sign, handled Bela, handled Dwight Frye, we talked about the guy that played Fritz, handled Criswell. Handled a lot of you know, those people. Supposedly the mortuary had an agreement with Hollywood Boulevard, and that they would not, or with the Chamber of Commerce, so they wouldn't drive funeral processions down Hollywood Boulevard. So Bela's funeral was at Good Shepherd Catholic Church in Beverly Hills, and he's buried at Holy Cross Cemetery. And they had to get from Hollywood to Beverly Hills. So the legend is that that Bela was in the back of the hearse, and the hearse driver was pulling out of the driveway, and he lost control of the hearse. He said the wheel was not literally ripped from his hand, but he could not control it, and the wheel took them onto Hollywood Boulevard. And he said he struggled with the wheel, could not get it under control until they passed the Hollywood Smoke Shop. So they said it was Bela's final farewell to Hollywood Boulevard.
That is really interesting. Wow.
It's a good story. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce didn't want funeral processions ruining the vibe.
Yeah, right?
The classy vibe of Hollywood Boulevard.
Oh, poor Bela. But yeah, so he's buried at Holy Cross in a Dracula suit, but not the cape. And
the legend is he's buried in the cape. So you're saying that's not true. That's
right. Yeah, he was. I think he was good friends with Forrest Ackerman, and Ackerman was that guy who had everything. He was Mr. Sci-Fi, they called him. He had a house he had a museum, and he was friends with Bela with all these guys. He had the original cape, and he had the original Dracula ring and all that business. And when Forrest Ackerman died, it all kind of went up into the sky and all landed all over the place. But Bela's cape did go up for auction. I think Julian's. I'm not sure it's sold, but the Academy has it, and they're going to put it in the museum. That's what they say.
That's fantastic. I need to go to the museum. It opened recently, by the way. It finally opened. I have friends who have gone. I have not gone. I have friends who don't live in LA who have gone, and I haven't gone yet.
Well, if you go to my YouTube channel, Mike, I walk through the whole museum with my camera.
Did
you? Yeah.
It'll be like
so
I'm actually there.
You'll see the entire museum. So
how'd you like it?
Yeah. I enjoyed it. I was expecting, I was hoping for a little bit more clutter. You know, I like it more to be a little bit more silly and hodgepodge. I don't need it to be designed within an inch of its life. And there was a lot of that. But that's the deal. That's what they did. Yeah. They hired, they had gajillions of dollars to do it. And they hired, you know, all these people to do it. So I would have liked to see more stuff. The Hollywood Museum, Hollywood History Museum on Highland, I love because it's so, it's just all wacky. You know, it's everywhere, something amazing. You know, the Self and Science of the Lambs. Oh, there's Mae West's, you know, doors. And it's the kind of stuff I like. I liked it a lot.
That's in and that's the one that's in the old barn that was it
demo? No, this one's the old Max Factor Museum.
Oh, okay.
Right. Hollywood History Museum is across from the bowl, Hollywood Bowl, in the old barn. You're right. And the Hollywood Museum, I guess they just call it, is on Hollywood and Highland in the old Max Factor building.
They
just have a cool collection of stuff. But to say, I love the Academy. It was wonderful. I was love seeing the ruby slippers and as a filmmaker, you'll lose your mind in there, you know, with the cameras and et cetera. It was very, and seeing R2-D2 and C-3PO, one of the 500 of them, you know, it was interesting, but I liked it. I enjoyed it. I definitely glad I went.
And I'm sure, you know, this is the opening. This is his first iteration. I'm sure over the years, they'll acquire more things. Yeah. And I think they'll have rotating exhibits. I'm also really, really, really excited about the movie theater that they built, which was somewhat divisive, though, the way it was the design. I think it looks like a big egg. It's like a ball.
Yeah.
But I think it's freaking really cool. And I can't wait to see a film in it. I think it'll be really exciting.
Yeah, so. It'll be. I hope it's, you know, the way they had it set up, because I was one of the donating members. So I got like to see the preview before it opened.
Right on.
And so it was awesome because you had to book it. You had a certain period of time to go. I don't know what it's going to be like otherwise. It was great because there's elbow room up. Like crazy. And there was, you know, you could go up to see the ruby slippers. There weren't 10,000 people there. You walk away and they're all by themselves and no one's there, and you can go back. You know, you could really take it all in if you want to. So I don't know if they're going to have a free for all policy after this. And, you know, there's going to be 1,000 people a time in each room. But the way I experienced it was really nice. I really enjoyed it.
I'm planning on joining it as like a member, and I got like I think I did do the early contribution. I think I donated like $25 or something like that. You know, when they were first doing like their fundraising, right? But I do plan on joining as a member. I'm a LACMA member, and that's next door, so it kind of makes sense to just join both of them, right? And I like supporting that kind of stuff. So
I did like $40 or $50, and I got the invitation out of that. So I was like, cool. You know, that's all right. I'll go for free. Sure.
I think I did look into it early on. I looked into how much you would need to contribute to get your name like on the wall.
Oh my gosh.
In the thing. And I think, don't quote me on this, but I think it was like $250,000 was the minimum to get up there.
Yeah. You know, it was a poncy, freaking, you know, pretentious. I hate these people. Okay, I'm going to tell you something. These people didn't give a crap about any of this stuff before. The Academy, yeah, I'm talking about, this goes back to Debbie Reynolds again. Debbie Reynolds, hard ass. She bought all those costumes, all those props from classic MGM movies. She spent her entire life, she mortgaged her house to get these things,
to save these costumes.
Freaking 7-year itch dress. She had she had, you know, costumes. She had the witch's hat. She had all these amazing costumes, and not a single person would give her the time of day. The Academy said, go to hell.
Right.
They didn't say that. Steven Spielberg, she had a meeting with him personally. No, sell it. David Geffen, no, get rid of it. The Academy, go, get rid of it. We don't want it. And all of a sudden, Debbie Reynolds, you know, it's close to death. She says, I got to sell this shit. And she, you know, put off on auction. And then they come to Todd Fisher, Debbie's son, and say, we want to use these costumes of your mother's. And he's like, what? He says, I'll tell you what, I'll do it, but I want you to name, you know, something like the Debbie Reynolds Pavilion in there, because she deserves that. It just rubs me the wrong way. These people didn't, you know, she knew what they had. Her heart was in it, and it mattered to her. And when she died, nobody cared. And now, you know, now they're all about you know, we're going to put, you know, I love what I saw. I just, yeah. I have a real chip on my shoulder when it comes to that
least,
stuff.
I guess it's better late than never, but yeah, it would have been nice if she could have got the glory while she was still around. And yeah,
I mean, she worked her butt off. She had like four deals. She had Hollywood and Highland was built specifically with her museum in mind, and it fell through. Right. Another one at the corner of Hollywood and Vine was supposed to happen. That didn't go through. Dollywood was supposed to happen. All these investors were like bugging out. And, and you know, so now you can pay $250,000 to get your name on a wall. You know, it's like, oh, screw you. You know, Debbie Reynolds has mortgaged her house to buy this stuff. And you're going to get your little name on the wall and feel good about that. Eat me. Well, that pisses me off. I'm sorry.
How do you really feel about it, though?
I think I'm just. I really do. I think I'm just in that. I find that to be really shitty. So
But again, anyway. Better late than never. At least it exists finally.
True.
Hollywood finally has like a big budget, fully funded history museum dedicated to the film industry. So hopefully it'll only get better and go from here. Yeah. Bela Lugosi. I don't know if we mentioned this. Bela Lugosi passed away from a heart attack on August 16th, 1956, and he was 73 years old. And then he hijacked his hearse from beyond the grave.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I met the woman who had the first line in Dracula. She's in the carriage in Dracula, and she plays this little girl with glasses on. I think she has the first line in the movie.
Sure, when the guy's on his way to the little village next to the castle. Renfield. Yeah.
Her name was Carla Lamely, and she was the niece of Carl Lamely, the producer, the head of Universal Studios, who founded it.
Oh, wild.
And and she was doing she died just a couple of years ago. She was like 104, but she was doing a thing at the Hollywood History Museum one night, so I went up there and got to take a picture with her. That was really cool to meet a woman who was in Dracula.
Hell,
in 1931 was really, really neat. And I got another story. I saw Bram Stoker's skull.
What?
Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, was cremated in London, and he's at Golders Green Crematorium, and he's in a locked area. So this is back in the 90s, early 90s, before there was the internet. So find a grave. None of that shit was around. And I was doing some research, so I went to Golders Green. And I was peeking actually in this locked area. Anna Pavlova, the ballerina, is in there. Sigmund Freud is in there. Conrad Veidt, the actor, he hadn't been moved there yet, but he's in there. And he ultimately was in there. But anyway, I talked to a guy who worked there, and he goes, oh, I'll show you. So we came on, and he unlocked the door, and we go up this weird staircase. And on the staircase is this little box. This is Bram Stoker on it. And I got to peek in, and he lifted up. And this is when they didn't pulverize. They cremated, but they didn't pulverize yet. So there are bones and bits of skull in there that I saw. So I saw Bram Stoker's skull in real life. And then they let me watch a cremation, which was crazy. They just, they're showing me around, and I got to go to the different, you know, ovens or retorts and see the whole process. It was really, they're so nice. I'm sure they wouldn't do it now, but that's where Amy Winehouse was cremated and Keith Moon and Mark Bolan and Peter Sellers and all these, George Michael was done there and Freddie Mercury. So everyone's been done at Golders Green, but yeah.
Wow. Did you want to talk about Lon Chaney Jr.?
No, we can skip that, actually.
And I think we'll probably skip Vincent Price, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, just as a mention, you know, and then not to be dismissive, because Phantom of the Opera is a great movie. It's a silent movie about opera. You know, which is interesting to note. I'm just saying. I'm not saying it's lacking anything. I'm just saying it was a silent movie. Who greenlit this? You know, although it's a classic. It's a classic story. And Lon Chaney, who was also played the Hunchback of Notre Dame before, played the Phantom, and it was really interesting and really very interesting. Actually, what was important to me to mention was that on a soundstage at Universal Studios for decades was the original wall from the Paris Opera House from Phantom of the Opera by Lon Chaney. Wow. So it was covered. It was still in the soundstage that they used. and it was covered, you know, obviously while they were filming other things, but it was there. And if you went to the tour, sometimes if they weren't filming in that particular soundstage, stage 28, it was also the stage where they filmed Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein. And also it should be noted that the same guy that did the props for Frankenstein was the guy that helped on Young Frankenstein and the Munsters. Because that Universal, that was Universal had the rights to the Munsters because it was Dracula and Frankenstein, etc. But anyway, stage 28 had the original wall from the Paris Opera House with the booth that the Phantom sat in, and they tore it down. We're talking about like 5 years ago they tore it down.
Right. They still had it.
Yeah. So that is kind of there you are. There you are. That's Hollywood. So,
you know what? Yeah. I did want to mention. I know we're close to wrapping this up, but we're talking about Lon Chaney, and Lon Chaney Jr. of course was the Wolfman, in Universal and all the sequels. The original Wolfman in 1941, and then the sequels. I thought it was interesting. You know, he obviously in the shadow of his father, who had died young, himself, and originally wasn't going into acting and didn't really pursue acting until after his father died. And I did not know anything really about Lon Chaney Jr., but apparently his mother attempted suicide in L.A. in 1913. She entered the theater, which is no longer there. It was a theater in downtown L.A., where Lon Chaney, the father, was working. She entered the theater and swallowed a vial of poison, but didn't die. But she was no longer a part of Lon Chaney Jr.'s life. And he apparently was led to believe that she was dead and did not know that she was still alive until after his father died in 1930.
Wow. That's something. Yep.
There's some drama.
So she committed suicide in a theater. She tried home.
She attempted, but didn't succeed. And then I don't know if she was committed after that or what happened, but he was apparently estranged from her from then on and was led to believe that she was dead and didn't know it until his father died that she was still
interesting
alive. Yep.
I knew that Lon Chaney Jr. wasn't called Lon Chaney Jr. until his father died.
Right.
He changed his own name from Creighton, I think.
Right.
It was his name. So, and then he became the Wolfman, and was that weird? I just read it on. I just saw it. Something like they're the only father son U.S. postage stamp people.
Oh, really? You
know, they both, when they did the Universal Monsters, both Lon Chaney Jr. and Lon Chaney ended up on the stamps.
Oh, wow!
U.S. postal stamps, different ones. So yeah. I think it's the only time that's happened. But and the other thing about Lon Chaney Sr. is that he made like almost 160 films. And of those 160 films, over 100 of them are lost. You know, I mean, just never found. They're just missing. You know,
something like 90%+ of films from the silent era are gone forever.
Yeah. So only 50 of his films out of almost 160 are here, you know, still survive. It's that's really interesting. Again, it says a lot about, well, you know, it was a disposable time. Nobody knew it was going to have the longevity.
There wasn't a good way to store it because film itself is extremely brittle and hard to store long term, and it's extremely flammable. And a lot of these old films were lost to fires, and also they just lost because the film fell apart. And to your point, because they were disposable, and you know theater houses just threw them away when they were done running them.
Did we ever talk about the silent movie theater murder?
I don't know if we've ever gone into that. No, not on the show. We should.
That's a great story. I mean, it's for a different time, but the irony of that being that the husband and wife that created the silent movie theater, the only American movie theater devoted just to silent movies over around Fairfax, you know, places where Charlie Chaplin would slip in or Clara Bow would slip in during a screening to see their own movies for the hell of it, you know?
Yeah.
And the man and the woman who created this place, he died from cancer from the chemicals of preserving the films. You know, and
wow.
But I mean, the story about the guy who inherited it getting murdered in the, you know, we should talk about this sometime. It's so much to take on. But his name was Lawrence Austin, and he was murdered in the at the box office of this, at right. this movie theater. But he was a film historian, and they saved, like, they have a lot of prints of movies that were long gone, thought to be gone. So so there is a real underground sort of industry in that kind of thing. A lot of collectors have these things, and right. you know, you don't know about it. And that's really interesting, because why would you want to keep something like that to yourself? It's so cool. That's the whole reason you have a movie, is to watch it. And what do you, you know, what would you do with it? You're just going to have it by yourself, watch it over and over again. It's an ego thing, I guess.
And what also happens is, because you know, the Library of Congress and these other film preservation organizations, what will happen is they will, sometimes they'll find these old films in pieces. They'll turn up, mm-hmm. you know, a few seconds of footage will show up in an old trailer that was in the, you know, the attic of a movie theater for 100 years that someone dug up, and they realize, oh my God, it's in the missing minute of this movie where we've only had, you know, 10 minutes of it in the past. And they'll find a way to kind of stitch different pieces together. Or sometimes, because of the way censorship worked back in the early days of film, different cities would have different cuts of the movie because they'd make their own censored cuts to things. It's really wild how they piece together these films to try and preserve them. And yeah, mm-hmm. who knows what is in people's private collections too, that they may not even realize are considered lost films.
Or probably that's the whole point. It's like people that have, you know, dinosaurs in their in their houses, you know. They spend like $25 million on a Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's like, well, I'm sure there's an underground, you know, ivory, and you know, there is a whole industry, I'm sure, like that. But it just seems, it's like we talked about James Dean's car, you know. It's like, okay, I have the car, now what?
You know, right.
I'm just sitting in my house and not telling anybody I have it. It's like the whole point of having that something that interesting is that you want to show people. So it's also very interesting. But so Lon Chaney, interestingly enough, what he was the his pallbearers, that was an interesting list of people. Did you see that? It's like Paul Byrne, who was murdered, you know, there's another Manson connection.
Yeah,
married to Jean Harlow, murdered in the house that or
committed
shot in
suicide
the head.
Officially, whatever.
Yeah. Jay Sebring ended up buying the house. L.B. Mayer, Louis Mayer, Lionel Barrymore, Todd Browning, and Ramon Navarro were all pallbearers at Lon Chaney's
Amazing.
Funeral. Yeah. And he's buried in an unmarked grave in at End Forest Lawn, Glendale, in the same mausoleum as James Whale.
Navarro's another one we should do a show on.
Yeah. Halloween
we'll find
Night,
a way
Murdered
to,
by
we'll
Hustlers.
We'll find a new one, yeah. Yep.
There's got to be like a heartthrob or something. Just not more silent movies. I can't.
No more silent movies. I can't do the research.
Oh my God. No, it's hard. It's hard. It's hard to sit through those. I didn't mind. We'll see Phantom of the Opera. That was like 55 minutes. It's like, yeah, sign me up. I'm good. You know, that's all right.
Also, I love the comedies, you know, like Chaplin. The physical comedy is so entertaining. You don't even notice.
I like the stunt stuff that they did. I mean, that crazy stuff where they're hanging over buildings, Buster Keaton, you know, and or Harold Lloyd, and all those
crazy
stunts that they did. Yeah.
Jumping off trains and things. Yeah, yeah.
Why not?
Speaking of film safety. Man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. That's a good way to end this thing, actually.
We brought it all the way around to
full circle. Full circle.
Unfortunately. All right. Well, thanks to everybody. It's the end of our 30th episode. So we went with the 1930s with the Universal Monsters. And
yeah, it was a lot of information, but thank you. Yeah. Thanks for watching. I'm glad that you like to spend the time with us, and we enjoy doing this. So thank you very much.
Yeah. And check out our Patreon, our Dearly Departed Pod over on Patreon, and $5 subscribers get advanced these episodes a few days in advance, and the $2 subscribers and $5 whoever subscribes, you also get access to we do extra, like what we call mini episodes every time we put out one of these. So
Yeah, they end up being like hour-long episodes too. Right. So it's dirt cheap mini, entertainment.
They're pretty long, yeah. So, and that's where we talk about kind of more recent occurrences, deaths, you know, recent death stuff and yeah. personal stuff. So yeah, check it out. And thank you all
thank
for
you.
Listening.
Yeah,
you're amazing.
Appreciate it.
And a belated happy Halloween and have a good November.
Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.